good evening, everyone, and welcome. We might make a start if we can. First of all, I need to apologise for the false advertising. The good news is that you won't have to listen to me for the entire evening. There's been a little bit more interest than I actually expected in this session, and as shown by the numbers. And on my right, Jennifer Lang and Tim Clark have also joined to make some comments on the topic. Jennifer is a partner at KPMG and I think the managing partner for insurance. Head of insurance. I didn't get the right title, head of insurance. And Tim, of course, is the chief actuary at IAG. So welcome to both of them. And my name, for those who don't know, is Kent Griffin, and I'm currently CFO at TAL. Format for this evening, what we're hoping to do is each of us here will probably make some comments for about 10 minutes, and then we very much want to open it up to comments and discussions. That's where we're really anticipating getting the value of this session. Secondly, this may need to be an apology, if you've come expecting to get a great deal of information around the technical implementation of ICAP, I apologise to you early, and the drinks out there may be where you want to head straight away. The background to this session came out of a number of discussions that I'd managed to be a part of in different places. A lot of people, I imagine most people here, are working on ICAP in some form or other at the moment. And in a number of different conversations I've been in, the comment was raised of, once you have ICAP and once you have a strong risk management function, once you have a chief risk officer, once you have a summary statement and annual report that's owned by the board that takes a very holistic view of risk, where does that leave the appointed actuary? In my background, which is primarily in life insurance, I had the privileged fortune to be appointed actuary with AXA for a number of years. And in that role, the appointed actuary and the financial condition report was viewed as the single document which gave a comprehensive analysis of risk across the company, to the extent that FCRs didn't just get done for the insurance company entity, but they also got done across all countries, even if they, at that stage, were across about 8 or 9 countries. We had FCRs for every country, regardless of the regulatory regime, and we had FCRs for non-life operations that effectively looked at it from a risk perspective. So there are certain companies out there, and AXA is now owned by AMP, so I'm not going to talk for them, but there are certainly companies out there that have viewed in the past the financial condition report and the role of the appointed actuary to be quite central to risk management. Another role that I have at the moment, which I'm very fortunate to have, is to be the convener of the Risk Management Practice Committee. And part of that, part of the discussions we have in that committee is around the role that actuaries play in risk management. There is, perhaps I describe it as a healthy tension within the profession that we see in different forums about where actuaries can actually practice in terms of risk management. At one extreme, there is a view that actuaries are a quite consummate group of risk professionals, that for decades, if not longer, we've been operating at a level where we've been providing advice in a range of different areas of insurance and broader to look at market risk, insurance risk, and we have actuaries operating in credit risk, operational risk and other areas. I've also been involved in discussions and forums where there's been another extreme of the view that's been expressed, which is that we're not trained in some of those areas. So how, as actuaries, can we practice in those areas? And I think one of the things that we certainly struggle with in the RMPC is a little bit before you can go out to the world to tell them what a great risk management professional the actuary can be, it would be nice to have a little bit more of a consistent view across the profession of how we actually viewed ourselves in risk management. Prior to ICAP and the developments under LAGIC with it, we at the RMPC were very heartened by what was in LPS GPS 220. Tim is going to focus a little bit more on what he talks about the risk practices and the appointed actuary in general insurance. But certainly what I put up here, and I apologise, I had anticipated a smaller group, is the excerpts from the from LPS 220 and GPS 220. Certainly in the life insurance environment, if you read that at the moment, you'd be forgiven for not believing that the appointed actuary is expected to have a strong holistic view of risk across a life insurance entity. And I don't mean by that simply the technical aspects of modelling reserves for insurance risk or market risk, but right from the aspects of governance through to policy, through to how you monitor and report on risk, and right through to how you build a risk culture within an organisation. In general insurance, the wording is a little bit different, but to the extent that I've been able to discuss this with general insurance colleagues, I get the views also pretty consistently that actuaries, if not necessarily quite as formally identified in that role, certainly play a very large role in risk management. So for the last few years in the RMPC, we've been quite driven by this as a premise for the appointed actuary to be out there to be really the consummate risk professional for life insurance and general insurance entities. So now ICAP's come along. I was having a... I've been at TAL for about 5 months, and in the first... Actually, the 2 weeks before I joined, I had my first email from Jim, who's our CEO, who said to me, it's great to have you on board, and I want you to know the first thing you're going to be doing is sponsoring the ICAP project in TAL. And I thought, this is great. I'm looking forward to this. So came on board, and there was a lot of work already underway. A few people in this room were key to that. And we actually got to the board in about August and did a dedicated two-hour session with the board on ICAP. And so we had a lot of discussion around this. And the question actually did come up. For us, for those not familiar with TAL, TAL is predominantly a in terms of new business anyway these days, a risk provider. And the life insurance entity is the core of our business. We don't have a lot outside it. And the question was on the table at the end of the session from one of the directors, which went along the lines of, well, look, this ICAP thing sounds great. We're very comfortable in the risk management processes we have. Very happy to see how it's developing. Where does this leave the appointed actuary? Everything you've described in terms of what we expect to see in the annual report for ICAP mirrors a lot of what we see already in the financial condition report for the company. So are we expecting this will replace the FCR? And of course, being a very committed actuarial professional, I had to sort of come up with an answer and said, no. They have very different roles to play. And it was at that point that I found it actually quite difficult to articulate what exactly these two different roles were they were going to play. Which sort of led us into a conversation at the time around where does risk management go, what is the role that the appointed actuary will play, and more specifically in terms of reports, does a board member really want to be getting an FCR and an ICAP that look very, very similar, based probably off very similar information, but really differing only in the sense that there's different people actually writing the opinions and owning it. This was a slide that, or a variation on a slide, I did take out some of the confidential bits, variation on a slide that I used with the board on that day. And the way we presented and talked about ICAP to the board was, I'll be interested to see if Ian jumps up and objects to anything I say here, but was really to say, look, ICAP is predominantly about what we already have in organisations. We have enterprise-wide risk management frameworks. Yes, I'm sure we could all do them better, but nonetheless, I'd be very surprised if we have organisations represented in this room today who don't already have an enterprise-wide risk management framework. Similarly, we have capital management frameworks, whether that's the capital analysis that comes through the financial condition report or through a capital management plan or through the strategic planning process, the elements of it are there. And we have a strategy and business framework. I'd be interested to know if there are any companies here that don't do strategic plans, where you certainly bring together what your key performance indicators and often now more broadly what your business is going to look like over the coming years. To me, ICAP has been, for the last few months at TAL, as much an exercise about simply bringing those together of what we already have, articulating them through the summary statement, looking at the material we'll put in the annual report, identifying areas where we need to strengthen things. I might use the term, there's a couple of gaps in there, but there's not a lot. But ultimately, this hasn't been about reinventing processes. This has simply been about drawing the links for them and bringing the board on that journey. Now, if I remember back to my days when I was mentioning the role in AXA, that was effectively what I used to do with the financial condition report, and I know that's what other appointed actuaries have done with financial condition reports. So it does beg the question now that if you've got the board owning this document, if you've got the management and the board signing it off, whether it's the CEO or the directors, where does that financial condition report sit? So in the interest of the session today, I've put up what may or may not be some slightly provocative statements. I'm hoping that we will get some comment on these. First of all, start with the premise that we have seen the expansion of the ICAP and the Chief Risk Officer from the banking environment into the insurance context. I've also had the opportunity to spend time working overseas and in Europe, and you certainly see this a lot more advanced than actually you see it in Australia at the moment. It's certainly, I believe, a global trend. LPS GPS 220 has afforded the profession, I believe, an opportunity in the past for the actuary to position themselves right at the core of the risk management framework in a company. And we've had that opening now for a number of years. To be slightly controversial, if I can, I think as a profession, we may not have quite stepped up to that as we could have. And I also think that we had that window, and quite possibly now with the developments of ICAP and Logic, we may actually be seeing that window start to close. There is a risk here that we've not stepped up to the challenge because we are concerned about what we are trained in and what we can practice in. And I'll come in a moment to some extracts I've made from the Code of Conduct. I can remember when I was studying to be an actuary, and I went along to my professional standards course, and I was told very clearly in my professional standards course that I shouldn't be doing anything as an actuary that I wasn't trained or experienced to do, and if I did want to do such things, I should seek the advice of a senior actuary who had practiced in there, and I should have the benefit of that before I'd be willing to practice in that area. It's what in a later slide I call the apprentice model. And I think that served the profession well. I think what sometimes we undervalue is the extent to which we build our experience after we do our formal training. The reality is, and I'm sure many in here are in a position of recruiting people, in the early years when people graduate, you usually recruit on the basis, at least from my perspective, of education and potential. That's really what you're looking for. By the time you get to be about 5 to 10 years out of your graduate studies or your program, you're recruiting for experience and the maturity that people show in terms of doing their work or being leaders. And I think sometimes as a profession we look to the formal education that we have and we put a value on that. We don't necessarily look to the experience that we develop and see that as a form of training as well. And I think if we did, we might open ourselves up to a few more possibilities. The role of the appointed actuary, so what might happen to it? Well, it could actually become quite marginalised. I did have the word marginalised on this, and I showed the slide to Melinda, who mentioned to be marginalised might be a little bit harsh. But I could actually see that happening. If you take away the financial condition report, if you take away a holistic document that looks at the strength and the risk of an organisation, what else are you left with for an actuary? You're left with someone in organisations, and I'll talk about life insurance specifically, who gives advice on pricing. That's important, but similarly in the banking environment, you don't need to have a statutory role for someone to give advice on pricing, nor do you need it in the wealth management environment. In terms of managing participating business, it's quite important for an actuary. An actuary is the person who balances up the policyholder, shareholder, and provides advice on that, expense apportion and so sort of thing. But for Australia now, that's largely a legacy set of business, and over time it will continue to diminish. The other area we're primarily in is reserves. And again, you want to have an actuary potentially doing your reserves and looking at the cash flows, but it doesn't need to be a statutory role. You have other financial institutions that require reserves that don't need a statutory role for it. So if we do see ICAAP and Chief Risk Officer functions well established in an organisation and being prepared to take holistic views, we're potentially seeing a situation where the appointed actuary will become much more towards the compliance end, towards looking at reserves, looking at pricing, and ultimately will diminish along with, or certainly in responsibility. The first bullet point on this one I wanted to make about loosely worded policyholder reasonable expectations. I find this is an interesting one. Again, when I was starting working as a young actuary, and a lot of the business around was still participating business, or indeed when I was working in Asia and we had a lot of participating business, there was a very strong role of the actuary in looking at the benefits to the policyholder versus the shareholder, how that split was managed. Indeed, one of the operations I was involved with in the UK, we actually restructured the CRO appointed actuary split, so effectively the appointed actuary became the policyholder actuary. And CRO was much more the shareholder view looking at risk. Even that part of the job of the appointed actuary now is starting to, I believe, being overtaken by regulation, particularly in the area of advice. A lot of things that have come out in terms of remuneration of advice, a number of the things that you see looking at misleading or mis-selling or even misunderstood sales at the moment are far more being driven by regulators than they necessarily are by actuarial advice in those product areas. And there's a few reviews on at the moment in different product areas people may be familiar with, where indeed I think the regulators have taken a stronger view on this, or a more advanced view than necessarily the actuarial profession has. So again, a question of where is the value that the appointed actuary brings in that. So look, I don't want to necessarily have us all completely depressed when we leave the room. I am actually quite optimistic. I'll flick through to this side. I actually think the actuarial profession is incredibly well positioned. I actually think we have strong experience in financial services. I think we've basically got a training in risk management that really exceeds what a lot of other professions have. I've managed to be involved in the ERM workshops that happen with people who are going through the education system at the moment. And a lot of the discussions that go on in those go well beyond the simple technical aspects of how to actually measure insurance risk or market risk or any of those areas. We have people out there. I've got to do a plug for a few of the people I know. We've got a few people out there that have been less concerned about worrying about whether they should be doing risk management and a little bit have got on with the job. And I'm hoping through the RNPC we will profile a few of these people in the coming months. Andrew Wallace-Barnett, who is an Australian actuary, actually left these shores about 10 years ago or more now. Andrew was actually founded the CRO function in one of the largest insurance companies in France, built it up, learning to speak French along the way, by the way. And then after that went on to work in AXA Equitable in New York, which is one of the biggest VA writers, and again, built up the CRO function in that space. Some people in the room might know Charlie Shamir. Charlie was global CRO for Munich, and then subsequently CRO for AIG. And there are others out there. So we have people in the profession who are already out there doing these roles. The question is how we actually support the profession more domestically in Australia to be able to do that. I think one of the key points that, and then I'll pass to Jennifer to make some comments. I think one of the key points we are going to have to get our minds around over the next few years is how we, as a profession, participate more in the risk management industry versus doing risk management as an actuarial profession. We've had a great benefit in the appointed actuary roles over the years that they've existed. They've given us a unique opportunity to be a role which is a profession nobody else can do. I was at a company many years ago where we made some changes to the actuarial function, some quite significant changes. And at the end of that year, we had 18 people sitting fellowship exams. Only one person passed, and that person was the one who'd been on extended leave for the last 12 months travelling around Europe. This, of course, was something that was quite concerning. So we engaged some people externally, and we got them to come in and run a number of sessions with our people to say, you know, what was going on. And I was actually expecting the normal range of answers. We're not paid enough. Somehow, usually, if you pay people more, they apparently pass easier. I haven't quite worked that one out, but that's usually on the top of the list. The next one was I expected was we were working them too hard, that they couldn't get access to their study leave, that they couldn't get time to actually do the subjects, or they weren't getting the broader experience. It was interesting that the number one reason people put forward was that they'd lost motivation, because they were seeing people within the company in the actuarial areas doing actuarial work who were non-actuaries. We'd changed the job descriptions. We'd allowed non-actuaries to work in the actuarial team. Our rule was the only person that had to be an actuary was the appointed actuary. As a profession, we're used to having this strong position where just showing up with our qualification means we can be in that actuarial area. If we're going to work in risk management, what we have to recognise is this is not a frontier science. There is a well-established risk management industry out there. There's a lot that people in that industry can learn from the actuarial profession. There's also a lot we can learn from them. And getting our profession to really work with those other groups and participate, I think, is going to be one of the key things that's going to help propel us into this industry. So I'm actually quite positive about this. I'm not as depressed as I sound. I think there's some great opportunities here, but I think as a profession, we really need to start becoming a little bit more outward-looking, really need to start involving ourselves in the broader industry. And really gain a recognition that it's no longer about dominating that space in terms of being an appointed actuary, but more participating in what is a very exciting industry.
Well, thanks, Kent. I'm not sure how I follow that rousing call to action. We're coming back to a bit more about ICAP and particularly about structural things about how the appointed actuary might fit together with ICAP. Some people in the room have heard me talk a little bit about some of these topics before, but I'll just quickly do a bit of a getting back to ICAP moment. And this is a slide which is very similar to Kent's point about ICAP is all about links between the risk management framework and capital. So it's just reminding people what needs to change with ICAP. It's about creating and recognising the links that already exist between the risk management framework, the risk management strategy, risk appetite, and the capital management framework. And then finally, the business planning process. So I like to think of it as capital is the price for risk. You can't always have a price for every single risk, but a way of thinking of the point of capital in this context is that capital is a way of measuring risk to help the business understand what risk actually means and what they should do about it. So looking at the risk implications, the capital charge associated with that, and then making the right business decision. Now, not every single risk can be measured that way. Strategic risk is one where a new M&A is either a good deal or a bad deal. It's hard to kind of measure that risk with capital, but it's a really good way of operationalising some aspects of your risk management framework. So linked with that and thinking through, this is all about links between the risk management framework and the capital management framework. The capital management framework being something that the actuary and particularly the appointed actuary has generally had guardianship of, but the risk management framework not so much. I guess the question is where does the appointed actuary fit into all this? Now, Kent's skipped over this slide. Thank you, Kent. So I get that one as well. So a lot of people will be familiar with this model of risk management. First line of defence is all about the business operations. Second line of defence about an independent risk and control and compliance function. Third line of defence, not just internal audit, but effectively oversight and assurance. So that's a very familiar model for most companies in terms of how to think about what risk management means and what roles different people play in that. And the question I have is, first of all, where should the appointed actuary be right now, and does anything change with ICAP? So in trying to figure that out, as well as looking at the changes in the standards, one of the things that I've looked at is some of my colleagues overseas have looked at different models of structures of actuaries, finance and risk management following Solvency II. Now, Solvency II is not exactly the same. There's a lot more internal modelling there as a matter of course. There's a lot of differences. There's no appointatory role. But I think it helps think through the framework of what's first line of defence, what's second line of defence, what's third line of defence, and where is the appointed actuary. So I guess this first slide I'll spend a bit of time on just explaining what all the different dots and colours mean. It's probably the most common structure that I've tended to see here in Australia, but it's not the only one. So you have a CFO and a CRO and an actuarial function sitting under the CFO, financial reporting as well and financial management sitting under the CFO, and then under the CRO you have a risk management function and a risk reporting function. Now I'm not sure if you can see the little green and red dots there, but basically what I've split those into is first line functions, functions that are both first and second line functions. So effectively what we've got there is the CRO and the risk management function are a kind of a combination of first and second line, as is the actuarial and the actuarial management function. So effectively the first line is where you're doing the calculations, second line is where you're reviewing them and setting policy for those things, and also reviewing frameworks of policy and general risk reporting. So I guess the question is, where is the appointed actuary in this function? If I look at a number of companies in the Australian market, you'd say that's clearly the actuarial function is where the appointed actuary sits. You've also probably got someone who's got a broader role than just the appointed actuary. They do a lot more things and are a major participant in the business than just being the appointed actuary. But that's generally where they sit. I guess another structure that is slightly different, not so different, but a little bit different, is combining the combining all of the reporting into one, where you have financial and actuarial reporting. So the actuarial function is less doing the kind of day-to-day calculations and management reporting, more doing the more technical capital type calculations, potentially pricing review work, those kinds of things. General actuarial management type function. You know, we haven't changed the CRO function. So I think there you'd have the appointed actuary still sitting running the actuarial function. And I guess finally, a function which has, it looks like it's nice and clean here because we've got first line and second line separated, but it has its own issues. And what we've done here is we've put all of the second line functions effectively under the CRO and all the first line functions effectively under the CFO, which means that you have you have actuarial people sitting in financial and actuarial reporting. You probably have them as well sitting under risk reporting. I didn't have any in financial management. It probably depends how you define financial management, whether you've got actuaries sitting in that group. But you've got the actuarial function purely doing the more review type roles that an actuarial function might traditionally do, sitting under the CRO. I guess there you would probably put the appointed actuary in the CRO function. And I guess the question of what of these different functional structures makes sense does depend on the company itself, how big it is, what kind of things are most important in a functional sense as opposed to in the way in which your interaction with the rest of the business. But I think it's interesting to think through, here are structures that have been set up to think about first and second line of defence. What does that mean for the appointed actuary role? And what is the appointed actuary role at the moment? And I guess coming back to, and I might actually come back to this, my earlier slide on three levels of risk management, I think many of the, probably most of the roles of the appointed actuary under the standards as they will go forward next year are much more in the second line of defence, independent risk control and compliance than they are in the first line of defence. And I guess the question is, where is that the right thing? If it is the right thing, is that the appointed actuary there, but you need actuarial professionals in the front line, in the first line of defence, and how senior should those people be? So one of the questions, I think, from any of these functions is, if we have effectively got a CFO and a CRO sitting on the management team aligned, how much actuarial responsibility and influence do those people have, and should both of those people in fact be actuaries? Are they actuaries who then have a more compliance appointed actuary reporting to them, or should in fact the CRO be the appointed actuary? A number of those questions to me come out of thinking through the changes, and I don't think you will necessarily see structural changes just because of ICAAP, but I think that if there are people thinking through different ways of organising the finance, risk and actuarial functions, then thinking through some of these first line, second line defence issues in terms of how you put them together may well hasten structural change or make the structural change happen differently because of it. Coming back to Kent's comments, I think one of the things that I think it's important, I'd really be interested in comments from the floor about, is this final structure, should the appointed actuary effectively be the CRO? Is it possible for the appointed actuary to be the CRO in the way in which the standards have been set up? And is that something that we should aim for? So with that, I'm going to hand over to Tim. He's going to talk a bit about general insurance.
The final point, or the final kind of part of this presentation, you heard kind of the overarching how should actuaries fit, then we heard a bit about the structural role that kind of Solvency II and how you think about it in a Solvency II regime. What I thought I'd do is take you through the journey that I've kind of gone through in my company, a bit more practical in the general insurance space, and give you kind of another level to start asking questions and comparing on. The GI space, I think the actuaries have evolved differently to how they have in the life insurance space. We definitely came in late to the general insurance industry. We definitely have played a role, I feel, much more coordinating a lot of various professionals. You can't talk about an appointed actuary role and risk mitigation in a general insurance without thinking about the reinsurance function, for example. And so there's kind of a natural coordination role the appointed actuaries have played in general insurance. The products tend to be a lot less homogeneous than my sense of in a life space. The investments tend to be a little bit more benign, hopefully, and that's how I'm trying to keep my chief investment officer at the moment. So the complexity that you have with a variable annuity product doesn't tend to exist in general insurance. It did in AIG's case, but hopefully not in mine. So it's kind of a different role to how I imagine it might be developing within a life space. Just to refresh, I think just to make sure we're all clear on this, the key things I think you've got to have in your ICAAP, it's all set out in the guidance notes and everything, but the things that we've been doing for a while within IAG, you're definitely linking your target capital to your risk appetite, and we'll talk a little bit about risk appetite. For companies with complicated legal structures and listed entities where you're raising debt financing, you've got to think about the form of the capital. And it's not just the form as in debt financing. We rent a lot of capital from reinsurers, the form and the availability of that. Where you've got lots of legal entities, you've got to think about the fungibility, how you're going to move capital around, not just kind of on a policy view, but actually this second point, in the stress situations. That's the crucial thinking. And this is where I think the rubber hits the road for the merging of ERM and ICAAP. It's where you actually take, and last year we did it with the board, we actually put up the newspaper headlines you don't want to read if you're a board member, but your risk appetite said this could happen. Can you look the stakeholder in the eye and say, we knowingly took that risk, we're disappointed about the outcome, but it was a potential. We got a lot of emotional buy-in. We didn't extend that session with the board, and that's what we'll be doing in my organisation. And I think that's the biggest benefit of the ICAAP and the way we link the ERM framework together with ICAAP. The example I'll think about at the moment is we've just bought in flood cover. We're getting potentially exposed to the unfair contracts terms. We have reinsurance that won't react in kind of the same way if we're forced under unfair contract terms, under flood cover, the person didn't think it was fair that we excluded it, etc. We've got this combination of events that could hit us, and it would be a significant risk management capital issue. That's only something you can take with a combination of professionals across your organisation to structure that scenario to have a think about it. So that's important. The four key elements, don't forget, we've got a summary statement, we've got the annual report, and the things that I think a little bit outside this debate about the FCR, the appointed acts preventing the advisor, everything, the CEO's got to sign off on this and the board's got to endorse it. It's a board's own thing. So we've got to advise them, but they're the ones signing off. I mean, that's where the ultimate responsibility sits. So we can be the key advisors on the topic. In our own ICAP over the years, we've thought a lot about time horizon. Again, the time horizon for your capital management, your capital planning, your ICAP probably is a bit shorter than some people are trying to drive their ERM frameworks to be. But you've got to try and decide on the time horizon you want your risk appetite to work with, the ICAP to work with, and where that kind of intersects with the longer term strategic risks you might be thinking about in your ERM framework. The risk appetite structure, that's another way of harmonising the two and how you pull that together. My advice to you is keep it as simple as possible and focus on the key objectives. I think, I don't think I'm speaking out of school, but for us, the board has decided it really wants to be able to balance the policyholder and shareholder interests, and therefore we actually have a risk appetite framed around regulatory insolvency. That's the primary consideration we take to the board. We then go and ask about total insolvency. We talk about rating agencies and our competitive position and all the other elements to it. But the primary risk appetite is defined around maintaining the board's ability to balance shareholder and policyholder interests. When you're talking about stress and scenario tests, again, what's the process you're going to go through to pull together what you might see coming out of your internal capital model, the reserve blowout, a nat cat through the top of your tower or something like that? What are you going to pull out from the ERM framework, so the unfair contract terms example I gave? How are you going to process that? How are you going to bring that to the board has been a lot of our considerations. We were just having a discussion with people who are developing their ICAP summary statement at the moment. There's a bit of a debate about who can get the smallest. And I think I'm winning because mine's going to be about 12 or 13 pages because I'm going to refer to a lot of the documents and the presentations that we already delivered to the board. It's kind of going to be the key output of this process is this presentation, this format, this discussion, and that's where it sits. So I'm not going to try and pull it into the summary statement because the point is to try and get the board to understand the whole picture. Other people are trying to put some of these documents into that space. My final kind of observations is actuaries naturally have a full understanding of the insurance value chain. As a reserving function, you kind of sit at the end of the chain, so you've got to understand how the policy was sold, what conditions were there, how the underwriter went about it, what claims management has gone on, what case estimation philosophies you've got going before you can set your IBNRs and your reserves. So you naturally have must develop an understanding of the insurance value chain, and therefore we're kind of a well-trained profession to sit in this space. We're not the only people who can do it, and I think that's the point that's been raised. So let's get out there and make sure our skills are utilised in this space. I mentioned the enterprise risk profile and the stress and scenarios is where you can really draw it together. A key one also for us is going to be the mitigations. If that scenario happens, what might your competitive situation look like? What might your balance sheet look like? What might your future investors want to do with you? And how good can that kind of mitigation happen? Can I go out and buy reinsurance? Can I buy a quota share? Can I run off an old book of business? You know, there's lots of things you can do, lots of management actions you can take. But how effective in the stress and the scenario that you take into the board will it be? And that's going to be useful to re-inform their risk appetite going forward. So I see kind of an annual process you go through. You set your risk appetite, you calculate your target capital and you measure against that, but then you run these stress and scenarios and that'll re-inform whether the board wants to change its risk appetite. Kind of the catchphrase I'm using with my board is business continuity planning for capital. That throws lots of events at the people and see how you react and see how effective those hypotheticals were so that you're ready in a real situation. So with those comments, that's the next slide. I pass back to the moderator. So thank you.
Testing. Is this on? Oh, good, no, it's okay. So, look, there's been a few different comments and thoughts that have gone through that. It'd be really great now to get comments from everyone here. By all means, please challenge or give alternative views to what we have. one of the things that I thought we could put up for discussion is really the way we go out of this session and respond to some of the points we've made will come at two levels. One will be what each of us does as individuals. So that'll be the matter of how many of us are already working in risk management and how many of us decide to have a career there over the coming years. There's another aspect to it, to what we can do as a professional body, and that's where we can do things to potentially look at the way the profession is developing and look at where we get involved. So three options, and there's probably many more that are up there on the slide. One is that we're comfortable with the current framework, we're comfortable with the positioning of the appointed actuary. It's pretty clear, we know how to answer the questions to our boards in the coming years, and basically we see how it evolves from here. There's another approach that we could be taking, which is to look at to what extent can the appointed actuary and the financial condition report overlap in the space of the CRO and the ICAP. I'm sure regulators and others will have views on this, and it may be that we want to, as a profession, suggest ways when the boards ask the question, why do we need both, that we could answer it with a possible alternative framework where the actuary can actually, point actuary could actually be the CRO, and the FCR and the ICAP could be presented as a single document. So that's some ideas to put up there which we could work on as a profession, but very, very happy now to get any comments or questions, please.
Kevin Hawthorne here. I disagree totally with what you've said, Kent. I see the ICAP summary statement and the FCR as fundamentally different purposes and different in everything. The ICAP summary statement is all about the directors actually understanding the things they've agreed to put in place to manage the risk of the organisation and manage the capital processes and identify. And so it should be all about who, what, when and where gets involved in informing them of the capital position of the company, who, what, when and where gets involved in getting capital into the company when it's needed. So they actually know who's doing what and who's responsible. To me, the FCR is all about saying you've agreed to all these policies and this is almost a track record of how things are evolving as distinct from these are the processes that you've agreed to. So as I said, I do think the actuary has a key role to play in that. And he can be involved in advising the directors, informing the who, what, when, where, and how things should be put together.
Can I just ask Kevin a quick question? One of the things that I'd see, what you've just said is the ICAP report, not so much the summary statement. So I think one of the things that Kent's suggesting and one of the questions that people are trying to figure out is how similar is the ICAP report to the FCR? Not so much the summary statement itself. The summary statement is more of a policy document. So apologies that you've already passed the microphone back, but it'd be interesting to hear what you think of that.
The summary statement can be an excerpt out of the FCR. It's an analysis of a change. And I think APRA had actually said they could see that happening. So I don't think that's the issue. It's the ICAP summary statement, which I think is the important thing, which is setting the platform.
Stuart Roger, practising mainly in health, and so was intending to talk a little bit later in the night. But I want to pick up the appointed actuary and all that stuff about what's the role of the appointed actuary. I've been a life insurance appointed actuary, currently health insurance appointed actuary for two insurers. There's two aspects to it. One is effectively chief or senior actuarial advisor to the organisation. And the other aspect of it is that there are some things that by law have to happen, so a position gets created. And whenever we're faced as what's the role of the so-and-so actuary, we need to go back to fundamentals and think through those two separate things. We had to do it in health insurance just 5 years ago when new Private Health Insurance Act came in. And in that domain, We came to the conclusion that, yes, financial condition report was really important, and the concept of the financial condition of an insurance entity was fundamental to that. But then we also came to the conclusion that the other area that needed attention from the senior actuarial advisor, and it became a regulated thing, although that's probably not essential, was about change. And whenever something changes in the health insurer or the prospect of change, then there's potentially actuarial advice required. So there's an article in the latest Actuary magazine about this, the notifiable circumstance regime. Health insurers, whenever something's going to change, whether it be the obvious things like product premiums or whether it be something as vague as a substantial redefinition of the risk profile of the insurer, they've got to notify the appointed actuary. The appointed actuary says whether actuarial advice is needed, and then basically you end up sorting out what's really needed. I just share that as an example of when things change and you look, we need as a profession to look at what should the appointed actuary be doing. We go back to fundamentals. It's the actuarial advice, and some of it is about risk management and how to avoid dot, dot, dot. But also some of it is about change introduction and how to dot, dot, dot. And both those elements need to be looked at whenever anyone's thinking about redefining the role of appointed actuary. And then going on to ask which of those should be legislated versus which of those just make sound good governance sense.
If I can just make a couple of comments and also on that and come back to what Kevin was saying. I think there's possibly two perspectives here. There's one perspective which looks at it from the actuary's perspective, where you can add value, what you can comment on. And I actually agree with what the first part of what Kevin said, which is the summary statement itself is, frankly, it should be a hygiene document. It's a document that said, I won't get all the bits that you said, Kevin, but the who, what, when, where, etc., it makes a lot of sense. And whether or not it's called a summary statement or not, I suspect various boards have access to various pieces of information or presentation that articulate this at various times and forms. And indeed, it's probably, wherever it's sat in the past, I think it's probably something appointed actuaries have relied upon. I guess the perspective I'm sort of thinking of, maybe if I can come at it from a slightly different way, is if a board now has to produce an ICAP document, they have to sign on the dotted line that they've taken ownership of it, that they endorse it, so the points Tim was making. Usually boards and senior management will look at things from an efficiency perspective. They won't hold to the minimum that the regulator has asked for. They'll say, we've got to do all this work anyway, so why would we produce the minimum? If you've done an ICAP document, let's expand it. I know certainly that's what our board's doing. Let's say, yeah, let's. We know what the minimum requirements are, but in other words, let's make this a document that's broader, that covers the risks of the organisation, that's forward-looking as well as retrospective and also going to the position we're in today. It's in that context I'm raising, and to Jennifer's point, it's not so much the summary statement, but the annual report. If the annual report's been developed in that context, then quite rightly, and the board's owning it, and the management's owning it, the question becomes, why do you actually need the FCR and the financial condition report? What extra added value is it actually bringing? I want to be clear, I'm not saying you don't want to have actuaries. Just particularly within an insurance business, you will want to have actuaries. The question is more, do you any longer need an appointed actuary? Do you any longer need a statutory financial condition report if you've got a board-owned annual report that is quite a full analysis of the risks and the required capital management linked right through into the strategic and business planning exercise? It's a question about what extra value does it bring. And that's where I think, to your point, Stuart, is that you then start to go back to fundamentals and you say, where do I actually want an actuary operating? And they were some of the points which might have got lost up there. Yeah, you want an actuary probably commenting on your reserves, particularly if it's insurance-based. You want some actuarial advice around pricing. I'm not saying that's going away. And there'll be some other aspects as well. But it goes to the heart of, do you actually still need a statutory role anymore? In the same way that if you look inside banking or you look inside some other aspects of financial services, you don't need statutory roles to perform those functions.
Bruce Vincent. I'll speak from a life insurance point of view. Firstly, I want to support Kevin. And Kent, I'm really perplexed by your comments. I mean, to me, the FCR covers a lot more than risk management and capital. And in fact, under LPS 220, it actually almost, I think, performs layer 3 review of a risk management process. So I certainly haven't had the experience that you say you've had in terms of the board questioning. If anything, under LPS 320, there's going to be more in the FCR, as far as I see it. So I'm really just perplexed by your comments. I think we don't need to speculate what is going to happen. We have LPS 320. We've got revised drafts. It's pretty clear to me how things are going to proceed. So I'm supporting Kevin, and I've sort of been perplexed by what you're saying.
John Evans from CBA. I guess I'm coming from the point of view of someone who's been fortunate or unfortunate enough, whichever way you like to look at it, of being in a bank and working on ICAAP since its inception in about 2008. So I guess when ICAAP became a requirement for the banks, we didn't really have a lot of guidance as to what was meant to go into them. It's a fairly generic set of principles that APRA put out, and we were sort of a little bit left to our own devices to decide what that meant. But I guess what we came to the conclusion was that, you know, the ICAAP is about, as the name says, you know, assessing how do you assess whether your capital is adequate. So really, it's every organisation, every financial organisation has a means of doing that already. So the ICAAP is really just saying, what do you do? So in document, you know, the ICAAP document in its first iteration was really just saying, well, what do we do? Let's bring all this stuff, excuse me, all this stuff together. apparently I can't say that. So really it's just a question of documenting what you do. And as I say, everyone has a process. It might be quite disparate and not very well joined up, and actually part of the benefit of documenting it is that it shows you where those issues fall. So, I mean, you know, and we're in the fortunate position in the banking industry where we don't have appointed actuaries. So the conflict, if you like, doesn't exist. But what it does mean is that, you know, the appointed actuary has a role already in every organisation in the capital adequacy assessment. So, you know, to say, well, where does the appointed actuary sit? The appointed actuary already has a role somewhere in that process. And it might not be the same in every organisation, but every insurance organisation has got an appointed actuary embedded somewhere in its, you know, capital assessment process. So I guess you find out where that is and then say, well, is that the right place? And are we identifying any conflicts here that maybe exist? So, I mean, you know, what we tend to put in into our ICAAP document is, you know, a description of basically how we view capital and what the numbers look like, and then the frameworks that support or the processes that sit behind the way we actually do that. And that, you know, has evolved over time, but when we look at the new guidance coming out from APRA, that's pretty much what it's asking for, I think. Ian's not quite so sure. And the final thing is on the FCR. I mean, I've been out of insurance business for a while, but I tend to, from what I know about the FCR, I see it more as an assessment, of an independent assessment as to whether those frameworks are in fact effective and working, and, you know, whether the numbers coming out of the process are reliable. Now, whether you join those two things together, I don't know, but I think I can see a distinct difference between an ICAAP process, which is basically what the business does and how it assesses its capital, and the assessment of whether that process is working adequately.
So just two things to respond to that. I mean, for me, an FCR is not so much just the status quo. It's a forward-looking assessment of the ability of the organisation to react to the risks thrown at it and the events that might throw it. And that's how I always think about it. There's a fair bit of historical documentation and the adequacy of past reserving and the process, but it's as much forward-looking as well, because the financial condition of a company, it's the balance sheet and the management today, and it's the ability to raise profits in the future to mitigate adverse outcomes is kind of the key elements of the financial strength of a company. So I'd be interested in your comment on that. But also just your experience in ICAP. What was there any improvement? Because this is about to answer the question whether I want to be doing the ICAP or not in an insurance company. But was there any improvement or not through the enforced discipline of the ICAP within the banking sector, do you think?
I'll answer the first one first. My comments about the FCR were really in the context of, as it described, the requirement to assess the risk management framework. It might have other elements to it as well, but purely in that context, I think that's what it would be doing in this, in terms of ICAP. So in terms of has it changed things, yes, it's changed it dramatically. I think it's probably fair to say that the capital management process was not well understood as an end-to-end process. There was definitely different elements of capital management that were going on that weren't really connected, was as well connected as they should be. And bringing all of those views together and really critically looking at whether we are bringing in everything that we should do, whether everything is being considered consistently, whether even that we're measuring things consistently between different views of capital, regulatory, economic, rating agencies. Are we making appropriate comparisons between those different regimes? Down to improving methodology, looking at relativities between different capital measures. There's a whole host of things that have improved, not least just the actual execution of the process itself. And I think one thing that has changed, actually, is probably the focus of the ICAP or the purpose of the ICAP document. I think when I sort of wrote the first one in 2008, it was very much seen as a document for the regulators to feed as part of the second line of the supervisory layer. Had an input into what our PCR would be. Prudential capital ratio for those. Don't know.
No, I'm getting used to
that. but I think it's become more of a board-owned document that is used with the regulator as well. So it's seen more as being a document that explains to the board how we're managing capital. And that can sometimes mean there's a slightly different emphasis on it.
We'll argue about who's got the mic. Fred Rowley. Just going back to the FCR ICAP report linkages. If from my reading of what's happening, the ICAP report is an extension of the FCR to concentrate more towards the capital management side of it. You know, if I look back a few years, I can think of companies where the substance of the FCR added together with the Treasury report would have probably covered all the topic areas. Probably in the last few years, the techniques and the depth of the coverage and so on have changed. The report itself doesn't set so many challenges. You know, companies, even mutuals, were thinking about capital management 10 years ago. Bloody hard, actually. But it's not so much the report itself. I think the thing that comes strongest out of the recent documentation is the urge to get the board ownership. And again, that certainly has changed over 10 years, no doubt. And also the linkages between the capital risk management frameworks and the business management, which again certainly weren't apparent 10 years ago in the same degree as you get it now. So from my point of view, that That's where the difference lies. If you go back and say, well, it's an extension of the report, well, you're then asking the question, you know, is there need for a statutory role? If I were in Ian Lachlan's shoes, I'd be saying, well, if you want to do that piece of the extension, you better prove you can. So looking at your 3 points up there, in the middle one, if your profession doesn't position itself as a profession to be capable of delivering those things, then we certainly will never get that prize. And looking at the diagrams that Jennifer put up, it's clear the CROs in those charts are higher up the chart than the appointed actuaries are, so if that's where you want to be, so be it. And so I think, but then as individuals, I think some actuaries will stay in the top bullet there and stick with what they're good at. And I think that's actually fair. There are some actuaries, you know, we're not all the same. There are some who are very good at being appointed actuaries who probably wouldn't make quite such good CROs. And there are vice versa. And there are probably a few remarkable individuals who can be both. But I certainly wouldn't expect the regulators to believe that we can all be good at both. So, again, I think I know what I'd say if I were in Ian's chair. I think that's probably enough from me. Thanks.
Is there not some strength for a regulator to have effectively a regulated profession, let's phrase it that way, as providing this service, so that on a there's some form of consistency, there's some way of controlling the profession to guide how we might think about things?
Yeah, you were looking at me when you said that. No?
Well, you were the one who just threw
the, yeah.
just threw the challenge, though, Fred.
Yeah, no, absolutely there is. And I'll develop that theme a little bit, actually. There is certainly value in having a profession that's regulated, even if it's self-regulated, as we are largely. The scenario here is not, you know, if the actuarial profession loses this territory, the scenario is not that lots of bright individuals out there will do it. The scenario is that some other profession will do it, and they won't necessarily have the same codes of conduct and ethical standards as we have, although, as a real warning, they might. And if they do, then they'll be, you know, really strong competitors. So, if they haven't, they shouldn't get the job, should they, in theory, but the fact is that the regulator is always going to be asking for something more than what the company is asking for of its own volition. I mean, that's the reality I've seen for a long time. So, and the something more is often based on requiring the appointed actuary or some other appointed person to do something that's, you know, bears in mind public interest as above the commercial interest alone. There's a balance there. And while I'm at it, I might as well plug. You were saying at the beginning, Kent, that no profession produces the education that equips the perfect CRO. That's absolutely right. But I will, of course, remind you about the CRA credential, which is provided by this profession and actually equips a lot of our younger people at least to step forward to that kind of role. So, and I think it would be... It would be sad if we had decided, in other words, to stay in bullet number one and not to equip ourselves for that. So that's why I'm in bullet two.
Take a vote later.
Hi, I'm Nolene Wolfe from Allianz. Just a comment on the ICAP and how I think it differs from the FCR. And I suppose the way I thought about the ICAP when the idea was first raised was by thinking about the board and what the roles and responsibilities of the board are. And I suppose I see that as, you know, there's four key roles. First of all, they have a very important role in appointing the person who steers the company. Secondly, they have an important role in providing strategic direction for the company. And as part of that strategic direction, they need to provide a view on risk appetite, first of all, because that helps the company make everyday business decisions. They need to be done in line with that risk appetite. And secondly, the board need to think about, if everything goes haywire, what are we going to do to get things back on track? And that can be either done by way of raising more capital or de-risking. And so I think, you know, that's really what the ICAP is to try and address. is the risk appetite and this second question. If everything goes haywire, what are we going to do? And that's not something that an AA should be making a decision on. It's a decision that should be made by the board. Therefore, the ICAP is clearly different to the FCR because, you know, while the AA can make recommendations, or the CRO or management indeed, the whole point about the ICAP is that it's owned by the board. It's the board that needs to make those decisions. And so that's where I see a very key distinction between what the ICAP is and indeed what these other documents are that exist.
I mean, I think that's a great point. I would say that this ownership point, and a number of people have made it already, the ICAP is strengthening certainly and making much more explicit the board's responsibility there to look at these things, although some might argue that directors' responsibilities have always had that, but certainly it's making it a lot more explicit. I think the interesting link there is to what extent you would have expect an appointed actuary in the financial condition report to do that same type of analysis. And this is, I guess, where I'm starting to see the overlap, is that, in effect, what we're going to end up with is analysis of the sort of things you mentioned. We're going to have an appointed actuary providing advice or recommendations to the board, and then through a separate report, we're going to have the board taking ownership of recommendations. It'll be quite interesting if we get to a point where there's inconsistencies between the annual report and the financial condition report. And that will place the directors in quite an interesting position of having received advice or recommendations and then having put something different into their own report. And it'll be interesting to see how that works out in practice.
Alex Stipton, Nolene, I thought you made some very good points there. I'm not quite as old as my comments might make me seem. As I understand it, the 1945 Life Act, and I come from insurance, by the way, was introduced to try and bring some rigour into the way life insurance companies were operated, and it worked well for a long time. And then one of the watersheds in the 1995 Life Act was that where before the actuary was responsible for pricing, it brought the responsibility onto the board. And I just see this as an evolution of something that has always been there, it always should have been there, it maybe wasn't as good as it could be, and we're getting to the point now where APRA is very clearly saying to everybody, the board is responsible for running the company. They will need professional advisors, and they will always go and seek them. And as you pointed out, Kent, that might sometimes put them in awkward positions if their advisors have different points of view. We've become a little bit fixed on the appointed actuary role, which didn't exist until 1995, although de facto there were appointed actuaries beforehand, but there certainly was no formal role of the appointed actuary before 1995. And so I'm not at all uncomfortable about the fact that the formal role in that sense might disappear, because I'd imagine the advice is always going to be needed, and as long as we step up and be good professional advisors and make ourselves relevant to the businesses that our boards are running, we'll always find a spot for ourselves. So I'm less fussed about that particular argument than just making sure that we are lifting ourselves beyond bullet one to other parts.
Brylan Cummings, KPMG. I just want to sort of have a more unique perspective on this. I have the pleasure of being the appointed actuary for Friendly Society and being involved with Friendly Societies. So Friendly Societies can have, some of them can have six employees, so, and an external appointed actuary. So once you start talking about that number of people, and this is a life company that has to comply with all the regulations, you start looking at some of this stuff and thinking, how does it actually make sense? How is it actually going to work? These boards rely heavily upon their appointed actuaries for advice, and they're not going to be in a situation where their ICAT report will say anything other than what the appointed actuary has said in the FCR. So I think it would be nice for some of these smaller companies if they had the option of saying, our FCR is our default, you know, ICAT report, and there's no necessity for them to basically, you know, copy out what the appointed actuary's comments are, change the words slightly, and then say, this is our report. They can simply endorse the appointed actuary's FCR and say, we agree with that, and have that as being their ICAP report.
Me again. That leads into another topic, which I thought you'd cover, actually, but it's not on the slides, but there is this...
I'm getting the wrap-up already.
Are we in the wrap-up?
It's okay. Keep going.
Okay. The process of adoption. That is when the someone has written the ICAP report with its inclusion of all the FCR by reference. then what happens next? The directors come to you and say, "Well, you drafted this for us," and then they ask the robust questions that APA refer to in the practice guide. How does that process go? How long does that take? What's the process by which they come to own this document somebody else has drafted for them? And you don't have to answer on behalf of TAL, but you know, just
no,
just
I don't. It
seems to me a bit like a due diligence process that they're trying to own this thing, and there's a lot in it that they didn't write themselves, which they might know something about. How do they get into it?
I think this is an interesting question. Nothing I'm saying is on behalf of TAL. There's the premise which you're making is that there'll be an FCR, which, in effect, the board will be able to, in some senses, rely on or adopt or in whatever way. And that in itself is an interesting point. If I can start there, there are two appointed actuaries who I've spoken to, not in relation to TAL, who actually would prefer that their financial condition reports remain their standalone documents, which they own. And they are expecting in their companies that the boards will actually develop separately their ICAP and then that they will actually receive that advice. So this is one of the things that one of the conversations I mentioned I was in that was sort of prompting some of this is do you actually have a process whereby, in effect, there is a common base of information that is prepared which might actually constitute 60, 70, 80% of an overlap between the ICAP and the FCR. And then what you're actually looking at is that base of information getting a level of commentary and interpretation from the appointed actuary versus a separate discussion or related discussion with the board and then simply coming the outworkings of that being two documents. Or are you indeed seeing two separate processes within organisations which will then come together and there's a due diligence process at the board level? And that and if you have the latter, the adoption process becomes somewhat fraught with difficulty to the extent that there are differences of views across the two documents, at the very least, because you've then got a board that's trying to marry up opinions between management, which ultimately they're going to have to endorse, and what's come through is a sort of independent set of recommendations from the appointed actuary, which they are in various forms at least obliged to listen to the recommendations, if not accept them. In short, I think the adoption, if it's a process whereby these reports are developed in tandem and are highly consistent, I think the process of adoption becomes a lot easier. If they're developed separately, the process of adoption will be far more difficult.
Paul Nuttall at CBA. I've been fortunate to be involved in both the productions of FCRs in the life insurance environment and also the ICAP in the banking environment for a few years. I see there's a lot of common ground between the two. At the end of the day, both documents are trying to look at the risks of the organisation in a prospective manner and helping the board manage those risks. I see that the board owning ICAP is exactly right for the reasons that other people have expressed. And I agree with Alex as well in terms of, from the statutory point of view, I think as a profession we shouldn't be too hung up on that. I think we should just recognise the fact that as actuaries we're well positioned to understand the risks of the organisation. And to get involved in advising the board on how to manage those risks. And I'm sure the industry will somehow work out how to fit together the ICAP and the FCR from a sort of document and mechanical point of view.
Thanks for that. In the interest... Sorry, Kevin. One more comment from Kevin.
I just want to follow up from Paul because it was something Fred said. The second bullet point, I think we are positioned already. I mean, I thought that a whole point of our training was understanding risk and risk management and providing capital advice. And to say we have to reposition the actuarial profession to that, I find that very offensive. I think we are there. And sure, it's up to the individuals to prove themselves and that we stand on our individual success as a profession. And so that's my last comment.
I agree we should stand on our success. So we set out today to be a little bit thought-provoking. We've offended and perplexed, and we've got a few people who were sort of in line, so I think we, at least we achieved that aim. I am getting the wind-up because we have to be out of here by 7:30, so thank you, everyone, for attending. Thank you to Tim and Jennifer for being part of it. There are drinks, I think I'm being told to point out. There are drinks out there, and we have a few more minutes if people also want to sort of stay around and talk.